From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. Believe it or not, it's been less than a year since the 2024 general election. And while there's still more than a year until voters cast a ballot in the 2026 midterms, it looks like the campaign cycle is officially underway. On Monday, September 15th, Republican Governor Joe Lombardo officially kicked off his reelection campaign in front of supporters at Rancho High School in Las Vegas. During the 25-minute speech, the governor touted his accomplishments, including raises for teachers and state workers, enacting policies meant to improve school accountability and access to attainable housing, and approving the Campus for Hope. Here's what he had to say.
For 34 years, I proudly wore the badge of the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, protecting our streets, standing up for victims, and making sure our communities were safe. 3 years ago, I turned in that badge and asked for your trust and confidence to continue that mission as your governor. That remains my motivation, keeping Nevada safe, strong, and full of opportunity. And now Donna and I would like to ask again for your support to finish the job we started.
Of course, Lombardo is not running unopposed. Two Democrats have so far announced their intent to run against Lombardo, Attorney General Aaron Ford and Washoe County Commissioner Alexis Hill. And already many expect Nevada's 2026 governor's race to be among the most closely watched races in the country. Here to help us sort it all out is Lucia Starbuck, politics reporter with KUNR Public Radio in Reno. First off, you're joining us from Governor Lombardo's Northern Nevada campaign launch event in Sparks. We saw hundreds of supporters at Rancho High School on Monday. What are you seeing in Sparks today?
Yeah, I'm in an industrial park at Western Nevada Supply Co. I'm kind of surrounded by stacks of PVC pipes. The speakers have started. You might hear them, or you might hear some trucks behind me. There's about 100 people here. Lawmakers are in attendance. Sparks Mayor Ed Lawson, a couple Republican state lawmakers, and about 100 people. And just waiting to hear the governor talk about his campaign reelection launch.
During his first campaign, Lombardo focused heavily on reopening the state after the pandemic. During his inaugural speech, he wanted to be known as the education governor. What does Lombardo say he wants to do with his second term?
So it seems like he wants to continue what he's done. And one thing he's saying is this idea of bringing balance to Carson City. It's a Democratic-controlled legislature, and he's touting again and again his record number of vetoes. And that's what I've heard from a couple attendees, too. They like that. They feel that he is standing up to the Democrats. A couple of things that he has vetoed, the three gun restriction bills that have gone on his desk twice now, for people under 21 to not have semi-automatic weapons, guns near election sites, guns in the hands of people convicted of hate crimes. He vetoed a bill to require paid family leave for private workers. So it seems like people are kind of happy that he's using his veto pen pretty strongly.
Speaking of Democrats, two have so far announced their intent to run against Lombardo, Attorney General Aaron Ford, as I mentioned, and also Washoe County Commissioner Alexis Hill. What do we know about their campaigns?
Yeah, from AG Ford, he's definitely had a lot of experience in the state legislature as the Senate Majority Leader. We saw during a couple of things that he has done. I mean, he has filed a lot of lawsuits challenging President Donald Trump. For election changes, trying to restore funding, things like that. During this session, we've seen him successfully increase penalties for fentanyl trafficking, and that's something that Lombardo has touted as well. He wasn't super successful this past legislative session. He did try to prohibit price gouging of essential goods, housing, food, medicine, and that was ultimately vetoed by the governor. With Commission Chair Alexis Hill, she's not as well known across the state. I'm not sure how many people know her outside of Washoe County. She's taken a lot of credit for helping create the large homeless shelter here in Washoe County. And then a couple of things she has promised to do is she wants to reform property tax, which I know you've covered, Paul, from this past legislative session. And she said that she would not support tax breaks for large corporations like Tesla, which helped get Tesla here in Story County, or the baseball park down in Las Vegas.
There's no Senate race in Nevada next year, meaning the governor's race will likely be the marquee race on the ballot. Do we have any sense of how competitive this race will be?
Oh, yeah, this is a very Nevada-centric election. NBC came out with a story back in July saying that Nevada is one of the most competitive. We are definitely going to be impacted by the Big Beautiful Bill. People are going to be impacted by loss of healthcare insurance or food benefits. So that's going to see how that'll impact people. You know, Republicans have been quick to point out that the no tax on tips is going to help Nevada workers. So how much that will actually benefit savings needs to be seen. But yeah, Nevada's going to be very competitive. Of course, we have to talk about our nonpartisans and kind of which way they'll go. But it's still a very purple state, and it I don't dare try to guess who will win the governor's race.
I know it's still incredibly early in the campaign cycle, but have you spoken to any voters yet? You know, what is on top of their mind?
When I talk to people about the election, they kind of grimace. It was a very intense election cycle last year, especially in Nevada. Very intense news cycle so far this year. I think the same topics will come up: housing, healthcare, how much money they have in their pocket. And of course, if you want someone who will stand up to Trump, or if you like what Trump's been doing so far.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Lucia Starbuck is the politics reporter for our sister station, KUNR in Reno. Lucia, as always, thank you so much. Latin music is not only popular, it's also big business. But some artists and their promoters say the Trump administration's immigration enforcement efforts are putting a damper on the industry. As Yvette Fernandez reports, Las Vegas is already seeing declining tourism, and September is typically a busy time for top Latino artists.
For the first time in the Tejano Takeover Festival's 20-plus years, ICE raids were a point of discussion between the festival's venue and the producers. Vegas Tejano Takeover has been held at the Westgate every summer for the last several years. This year, festival producer David Chavez says the venue directly asked him,
"Do you really want us to draw attention that you're going to be having a big Hispanic event?" We said, "Of course. I want to do it more now than ever because we have to stand up." So guess what? That you walk outside and you're going to see the Vegas Tejano Takeover here at Westgate.
Chavez says hotel officials told him the venue has the right to not allow ICE on site since it is private property. But he adds,
"The whole industry of the Spanish dominant music and entertainment is hurting."
He says ticket sales at the July event were down around 10% this year. Other concert organizers say the U.S. State Department denying visas is having a chilling effect. The band Los Alegres del Barranco say the government denied their visas to perform at the Michelada Music Festival in Chicago. So festival producers booked the popular band Grupo Firme instead, but their visas were placed under administrative review. Co-owner Miguel Torres says this forced them to cancel the two-day festival just weeks before it was scheduled to open in July.
This cancellation has cost us a few millions of dollars.
Torres says there's a widespread economic cost when large community events are canceled.
It affects local talent, local artists. It affects independent contractor companies. It affects our team members. It affects restaurants, small businesses. There's a massive ripple effect.
The ripple effect isn't limited to community festivals. Even internationally known artists in this genre are being affected. Julian Alvarez and Peso Pluma both had their U.S. visas revoked this year. In 2023, Peso Pluma beat Taylor Swift as the most streamed artist on YouTube. Promoters who talked to KNPR said they take issue with the indiscriminate way immigration enforcement is being carried out.
"It's very racist. I mean, very racist."
That's talent agent Joey Rodriguez. He was repping the group Los Musicales at the Tejano Takeover in Las Vegas.
"ICE is showing up to the Tejano events. They don't understand the difference between Tejanos and Mexicanos."
Tejano, or Tex-Mex, performers and fans are predominantly bilingual Americans. In response to KNPR's inquiry, the State Department provided a statement saying, due to visa record confidentiality, it would not comment on specific cases. The threat of a decrease in Spanish language concert attendance comes at a time when the overall number of Las Vegas visitors has dropped by 12%. That's according to the Convention and Visitors Authority's latest data on the $55 billion entertainment industry, comparing this July with the previous year. September is typically a busy time for Latino artists in Las Vegas. Last September saw nearly 3.5 million tourists, more than half from Mexico. The LVCVA expects a decrease this year. Many, like agent Joy Rodriguez and Michelada producer Miguel Torres, believe things will get worse before getting better.
It's the worst thing that could ever happen because it's affecting a lot of people. It really is. It's really, really not good. I mean, it's not good for the economy. It's not good for anything.
We feel that this current administration is, they're targeting our community. They're targeting our culture, our people.
But ultimately, these producers and artists say there's more at stake than just a music show.
We have to show that we're not going to be intimidated. We are going to get our power back, and we need to keep moving forward.
This administration is actively targeting our people and our culture. If we just pack it up and stop showing out and representing and hosting a safe place for our culture, I think they win. And so, you know, we're not going to do that.
For KNPR News, I'm Yvette Fernandez in Las Vegas.
Many of us value our alone time, those few moments a day when we can unwind and just be ourselves. Now imagine if that alone time went on and on and on for what felt like forever. Now imagine you're spending that time in a box no larger than a parking space. There are no windows, no clocks, no way to tell time or keep yourself preoccupied. It's just you and your thoughts. What you've imagined is essentially solitary confinement. It's an incredibly common practice in the American prison system, where inmates can go 22 to 24 hours a day with little to no human contact. Here in Nevada, as much as 1/10 of the state's entire prison population is currently in solitary confinement. So what impact does the practice have on prisoners? And what does it say about the country's incarceration system as a whole? I talked about it with Hannah Truby, the managing editor of the Sierra Nevada Ally. Truby recently published a 3-part series looking at the use of solitary confinement in Nevada and the rest of the country. Here's that conversation. Hannah, thank you for chatting with me.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Talk to me about Frank De Palma. Who is he?
Yeah, so I first met Frank at a book reading here in Reno a couple of months prior, but he was a man who was incarcerated at Ely State Prison, 22 years in solitary confinement there at Ely, and I think 46 years in total within different Nevada state institutions. But he, since his release in 2018, he's become kind of an advocate for prison reform, and he's written a book about his experience, which is how I first met him. So yeah, as soon as I heard his story, I just kind of wanted to follow along more closely.
When we talk about solitary confinement, what are we talking about?
So it ranges. There's no agreed upon definition for solitary confinement. It can be anywhere from 22 to 24 hours a day in. It's usually the cell the size of a parking space is how I've been kind of explained to about it. It's usually 4 by 6 feet. It's usually windowless. And usually they get almost no human contact, very little meaningful human contact. Sometimes they get like an hour in the yard or, you know, they can receive visitors from time to time. But usually it's no human contact as well.
In De Palma's case, he was put in solitary confinement for his own protection. Is that a common practice?
Solitary confinement can be used for a number of reasons. It can be used for certain infractions, I guess, to keep certain people of the prison population safe. So in Frank's case, he was the victim of kind of a gang-related infraction. And so for his safety, as well as the safety of the prisoners, the, you know, Department of Correction staff said, we got to put this guy in solitary. And it is very common. It can be used for any length of time. You know, there's people I've heard about in my research that spend decades like Frank did.
Currently, do we know how many people are in solitary confinement within the Nevada Department of Corrections?
Okay, yes. So in Nevada, 10% of the prison population is in solitary, which is about 1,059 people. And the total custodial population is 10,400, give or take.
Is that a high number?
Yes, Nevada has are like for in terms of, population or percentage of population, it is a high number.
Why is that? What's the reason for that high number?
Yeah, great question. I think kind of just what I've taken from speaking with experts, it seems like there's a lot of a big lack of oversight within institutions like Ely State Prison or, High Desert. I believe a couple of years ago they passed Senate Bill 307, and that bill was meant to kind of limit solitary confinement to more extreme circumstances and also limit it to up to 15 days at a time. However, they have no idea how that's even being enforced or monitored. And so I think I haven't looked at other states, but Nevada specifically, there's a lot of questions and gray areas to how that's exactly being monitored and enforced, especially with that high number.
When did solitary confinement become this kind of de facto tool to punish incarcerated people or even protect them?
Yeah, I guess it kind of became a routine method with the rise of supermax prisons in the 80s and 90s, with the war on crimes, more supermax prisons were being created. And the difference between regular prisons and more supermax prisons are their like tools of isolation that they use. And so we saw a big increase in solitary confinement after not seeing it for a long time in the States around the 80s and 90s, and then more so into the 2000s. What is distinct is just how extensive we use it here in the United States. So, like I said, we can use it for anywhere from days to weeks to months to decades. But in other countries, they usually draw the line at no more than several days at a time. Because, like in places like, Scandinavian countries like Norway and Sweden, they have very well documented the effects of prolonged isolation and their effects on, when they return to the general population or even just to the society, the recidivism rates are worse off. They experience a harder time reintegrating into normal society, and so I think that they have a much more stricter, I guess, stricter line than we do.
Let's get back to Frank De Palma. During his time in solitary, he told you that he largely became a ghost. What did he mean by that?
Yeah, so he, gosh, I mean, this part was just the part that I think really hits everyone so hard is just hearing Frank talk about how he just kind of slowly lost himself for 22 years. I mean, if you think about it, it's complete isolation, total silence, no human contact. And in the, early years, he would kind of turn inward and he would create these whole internal worlds, excuse me, so he could kind of get a sense of human connection with that he wasn't getting in real life. So he would have, he met a woman in a supermarket and they got married, he had children, he was a father, all these things that he started kind of slowly building up in his mind to kind of, I guess, satiate that need for human connection. But then as time went on, even that became unbearable for him. He said that like eventually reality would come crashing in and he just completely lost himself. He says the last 6 years of solitary, he has no memory of. He said he just became a hand reaching for his food tray every day. He said his father died in that time and he was notified, but he does not remember being notified. People came to visit him. He doesn't remember that either. I just think it completely chips away at your entire sense of self.
Is that experience common for people in solitary confinement?
It is, yeah. So, I mean, I haven't spoken with anyone who has experienced solitary as long as Frank had, but even within a matter of days, you see profound effects in terms of, kind of losing your grip on. I mean, you don't have sunlight, you don't have a clock, you don't have the normal trackers of time, and so even within a matter of days, you become completely. I don't know. I guess you just become completely. You have nothing to depend on, and so we see the effects of like the physiological effects of solitary confinement even after a matter of days. People become more paranoid, their anxiety increases, all of these things, and then obviously it just becomes compounded the longer you're in there.
Have you reached out to NDOC in all of this? What have they had to say about their use of solitary confinement?
I have, yeah, reached out to them many times over the weeks of my reporting on this, and I never heard back. I never spoke directly with them. I reached out to them, I think, 3 or 4 times for comment, but I never heard back.
Reading your reporting about Frank, it seems like he's at least doing better. He's out, he's become an advocate for those who've faced solitary confinement. He helped present testimony on SB 307. A bill that would look to limit the use of solitary confinement. What is his takeaway from his experience?
I was talking to him actually about the passage of Senate Bill 307. And he says, everyone asks me if I'm happy about this. And of course I am. But he's really skeptical just because while the passage of the bill, was a major step in the right direction, there's still more work to be done, as advocates of prison reform well know. Advocates and legislators will need to monitor the law's implementation, and that's just unclear exactly as to how that's being done. But he is doing a lot better. It's just really remarkable that he is where he is, you know, not back in prison or in, you know, with failing health or in a mental institution, because the odds were really stacked against him. People who've been in solitary are much more likely to reoffend, I think by 67%, than people who haven't experienced solitary. And so he's really, yeah, he's doing the damn thing and he's doing it well. So yeah, he wrote a book about his experience, like I said. And since then, I think conversation has been sparked more so since the bill's passage, as well as since he's been released. So things are looking up, at least.
Hannah Truby, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Summerlin South Little League team made history in August by becoming the first team from Nevada to win the U.S. championship. Here's a bit of the call from ESPN as relief pitcher Luke D'Ambrosio delivered the final pitch of that game against Connecticut.
Now ready. Called strike three, and that's it. The Summerlin South Little Leaguers find the summit. They are United States Little League World Series champions.
These boys can hit, and we've known that the whole time. Both teams could. Nevada just came through with some big hits, saw a lot of pitches.
Now the team is back home, where they've become local celebrities. On August 27th, the Las Vegas community celebrated the team's victory with a parade. This week, they lit the Al Davis Memorial Torch at Allegiant Stadium as part of the Raiders' first home game. It's been a whirlwind few weeks for the team. At least, that's what TJ Fecture told me. He was the manager of the Summerlin South team. He's also the father of Brooks, who plays center field. Here's that conversation. First off, thank you both for being here, and congratulations to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Paul.
Brooks, let's start with you. Lots of ups and downs this season. First off, what have you made of this experience? Has it all sunk in yet?
Yeah, most of it has. I'm still coming to like realize how great it is and how lucky we have been to experience this.
Coach, take me through the season. Obviously, we know where you ended up, but at what point did you know that this team was special?
Getting out of our district tournament here in Las Vegas is very difficult. There's a lot of competitive baseball here in Las Vegas. But going up to state and challenging what should be the best of Nevada, and there was a great Paseo Verde team who went to the Little League World Series last year, and we had a great matchup with them, and we proved victorious. At that point, I knew we could compete.
Brooks, when did you know that this was not going to be a normal Little League experience?
Well, I always knew at the start our team was very good, and in 12U we made a couple of changes, and our team had a lot of athleticism and the thought to win.
So tell me a little bit about Little League. I think it may have changed since I played, 30-some-odd years ago. Coach, talk me through the season. When does it begin? How old are these boys? Who's all playing?
So really the traditional model you're familiar with still exists. There's that spring season, which is really the Little League season. In our league, Summerlin South Little League, we have a draft in January where we have an evaluation period for some of the divisions. We start from T-ball and go all the way to majors. So we really take kids from 4 years old up to 12. The higher divisions, we have an evaluation where we find and judge talent by age and ability. And the draft sort of spreads it out distributively, and we compete. We compete throughout the season. End of May is our championship week for Summerlin South. And then right after that, we choose all-star teams. And then the all-star teams for the 10, 11, and 12U ages compete throughout the summer. The 12U division is the only one that can go beyond the state of Nevada and go on to Williamsport, which we succeeded with.
Now, I won't lie. There were a few times during this series where it looked like you wouldn't make it. What was going through your mind when you were out there, Brooks?
Well, it started in districts when we played Pacoli. We were up 8-1 in the bottom of the sixth, and they ended up hitting 2 3-run home runs. And at that point, it was bringing me back to 10U and 11U, where they ended up beating us in the championship and coming back. But we held it together, and we got a couple more outs, and we won the game.
What about you, Coach? You know, what goes through your mind? You know, what do you say to these guys to help them refocus, you know, when the game is on the line? You know, what do you tell them?
I think a key word you said was refocus, but we don't want to break focus in the first place. You know, I think you're going to make errors, which is generally a lack of focus, but to quickly re-engage as a team and believe in yourselves. We had a couple of games where we were down a bit. We understood what we were, and we knew we'd have our chance. You know, so we never lost our focus. We may have gotten behind, but we reengaged quickly and didn't get down. So just maintaining that focus. And also as coaches, it's important that we stay even keeled and don't get too up or down because the kids feed off of that.
You know, of course, in the end, the team did drop the World Championship game against Taipei. That was a very hard-fought game. You could see it on everyone's face. You know, have you guys talked about that at all?
A little bit. It was unfortunate that I didn't get to play that game because I wasn't feeling that well. Mm-hmm. But Chinese Taipei, they were a good team, and they fought well against us.
Yeah, from a team aspect, I mean, no one, at least we don't enjoy losing.
No,
I mean, so that's not in our fabric. Really, they took it like champion. They didn't dwell on it. It really was almost, strangely, it was almost like we had lost a regular season baseball game. And we're like, ugh, we should have done this. And wasn't like, oh, no. Like, there was no, really very little dwelling on this. The kids very quickly were playing wiffle ball after the game and having fun. They're kids. So there was not a, oh, my gosh, we have to get together and talk for an hour through this decompress. We were competitors, and we know how to take wins and losses appropriately.
Yeah.
All right, Brooks, you have to tell me, what is it like to have a parade thrown in your honor?
Well, I love parades. I love how everybody comes to see you, and everybody's just cheering you, and you see people who you know and your friends from Little League and school, and it's just so awesome.
Now, I wasn't there. I didn't get to see it. Did you throw candy?
No. Or in Pennsylvania, people threw candy at us, but we didn't throw any candy out.
What's it been like at school? Are you a celebrity now?
Yeah, I was a celebrity for the first couple of weeks, and I still am. When I got back to school, my locker was filled with Diet Cokes because I drink a Diet Coke before every game. And okay. Everybody was just crowding me and asking, like, what was your favorite part and how was the experience and all of that.
Well, you know I have to ask you, what was your favorite part?
My favorite part would probably be, like, playing different teams from around the world and just, like, spending time with my friends in the bunks.
What do you think your favorite part was, TJ?
I love seeing growth in people and showing progress. And this team came in very talented, and we had a short time to put this team together to act like a squad. And we were able to really physical our way through the early games through sheer talent. But as we faced talented pitchers and defenses, we really played a sharper game. So I love seeing the growth and our, like, progressive coaches and kids competing.
You all have done a lot since the end of the series. There was the parade, talking to TV stations, the paper, the radio station. You lit the Al Davis Memorial torch at the Allegiant Stadium on Monday. TJ, let me ask you, have you been able to actually sit down and actually process everything?
No. I mean, in full candor, I've watched one game. I watched our first game, and I said, I don't have time for this. It's a focus ahead, and this journey is still going. And I refuse to watch those and really think it through until our current journey's done, because there's so much still to learn and enjoy. I foresee probably sometime in the winter taking a break and enjoying it, and hopefully enjoying it throughout our whole lives.
Yeah.
Brooks, things are probably about to settle down real soon. Everything will get back to normal. What do you think you're most excited about?
I'm probably most excited to see my younger brother play in Little League. And I'm going to miss being on that field, but it'll still be really exciting to see my younger brother and my dad still be on the field.
What about baseball? Do you think you'll play next season?
I can't play for Little League, but I still play club ball.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing you out there. Thank you both so much for chatting with me.
Super. Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you.
walking. We'll keep walking. You're with us. You're with us.
Come on, keep walking. Keep walking. That's right. That's right. Be out here in the sunshine. Just having fun.
Gonna be all right, okay?
She's loosening now.
Okay, yeah. Good. Okay, good. All right. She is? Yeah, promise me that you're gonna keep walking. You promise?
Las Vegas horror fans know J.T. Mulner as the creative director of the long-running Freakling Brothers horror show Halloween Haunts. International horror fans now know Mulner as the creative force behind the 2024 indie breakout film Strange Darling. And now, even more fans will discover him as the writer and adapter of Stephen King's classic story The Long Walk, which was released in theaters September 12th. In its first weekend, the critically acclaimed movie made $11.5 million, solidifying Mulner's status as the most successful filmmaker to come out of Las Vegas. State of Nevada producer Mike Bravatt spoke to Mulner after The Long Walk's release. Here's that conversation.
Hi, JT. Welcome to State of Nevada.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, thanks for being here. So how did your journey with The Long Walk begin?
I just finished directing and writing a movie called Strange Darling, and I was in post-production on it. And it was a really arduous process shooting the movie, and I was incredibly drained in a way where I just thought I couldn't direct something else right away, but I still wanted to work. And I remember Roy Lee, my producer, saying, what do you want to do next? And I was like, well, what I think I'd really like to do right now is just write something for somebody else so I can just spend a few months in my office at the keyboard and in the quiet. And he said, I know you love Stephen King. How would you like to write The Long Walk? And I said, I would love to write it.
What did you think The Long Walk was ultimately about? And how did you want your script to reflect that?
There's so many things it's saying and so many observations it's making about the human condition, which is mind-blowing because Stephen King wrote it at 19. And I was attracted to all those observations. One of the things I'll say I recognized in the book was this sort of, I mean, there's the obvious Vietnam metaphor, but for me, there was this sort of Scrooge story embedded in it. It had something to say about the rat race and the goals we have in life and gathering all these things, getting all these riches. Once you get to the end, nothing matters but the relationships you had. I also love the fact that he was commenting on relationships and being in the moment. And it's not always about the end. Stephen King was saying a lot about that in the book, and it was way ahead of itself. And then, you know, obviously there's very strong commentary on authoritarianism. You know, I think that's something that anybody can relate to. Slipping into that sort of cycle, and the cycle of violence as well, is another thing that there was an amalgamation of things that were being sort of observed and talked about over the course of this walk.
Now, this is a fairly loyal adaptation of the novella, but you do take some creative license with some parts of the movie. You mentioned, you know, about dialogue earlier. You especially take some license, and I will not spoil it, the ending. And I'm wondering, how empowered did you feel in making changes to this much beloved source material?
I was cautiously optimistic because I'd seen an interview with Stephen King where he talked about Frank Darabont's The Mist.
Yeah.
And that's one of my favorite Stephen King adaptations as a movie because Darabont's a brilliant director. But he also decided to go so hard with the ending and it was different than the movie. And I remember hearing Stephen King say, he didn't just say he liked it. He said he liked it better than his ending. And I thought, wow, here you have this guy who's a living legend and he's alive and he's prolific and he would have every right to be totally precious with his work. And this guy came at this with no ego and a totally open mind. And I thought to myself, at least I know I can present this to him. And if he says he doesn't like it, at least it won't be because of ego. It'll be because he really doesn't think it works. It was very, very exciting when we made that change that we got his thumbs up.
And speaking of Stephen King liking it, critics and audiences really, really like this film. As of this interview, it has a 90% rating on the Rotten Tomatoes tomato meter. And you enjoyed similar approval for Strange Darling, which you directed and wrote. I'm wondering, have you been able to process this reception that you've received in the last 15 or 16 months to your movies?
It feels really good. I'm one of those filmmakers who it's hard for me to make something with others in mind. I don't really know how to make something unless I just make something that I'd like. So sometimes that works out where other people like it, and it's the best feeling ever because you're really making a movie so people will sit in the theater and watch it. When people receive something well, it gives you more opportunities, which is always the most important thing.
Now, speaking of additional opportunities, JT, it's been announced you will adapt and direct another Stephen King book, this one, 1999's The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon, and this is through the same distributor as The Long Walk, which is Lionsgate. What drew you to this project, and when would you start working on it?
It's funny you'd say that because I've got the book right next to my computer here right now. I got my notebook right next to that. And I've kind of been with Trisha in the woods for, you know, most of the summer. And I'm getting close to the end. It means a lot to me personally. I wasn't necessarily, you know, on the lookout to just do another Stephen King thing right away. But Roy Lee happened to have the rights to Tom Gordon. And my mom was an avid Stephen King reader. She still is. And this book has always been her very favorite of his. I remember when I first kind of decided to move to LA and attempt to start writing and directing movies, I remember I told my mom, I said, if I'm ever in a position to write and direct movies for studios, I'm going to make this into a movie for you.
You are still involved with the Freakling Brothers horror shows that your family began decades ago. Obviously, you're a very busy man, and that is one of the reasons why you and your family have decided to pause the Freakling Brothers horror shows for this year. I'm wondering, JT, was that a hard decision to make, given that it has been so beloved in the city for some 30-odd years and has done so well?
Very, very tough decision. Halloween for us is so much more than a business. It's how we celebrate the holiday, the month of October, and I got born into this, so I don't know any other way. I don't think I trick-or-treated maybe once, but every other Halloween was spent either scaring people or watching my dad scare people. We are very much a haunted house family, and my dad and I, you know, still design the attractions and run the company with the help of some amazing managers. The plan is not to go away. It's to come back the following year. I just got incredibly overwhelmed with film work. We could have still operated, but I just knew that we wanted to create something new because we've been promising that for a number of years. And I thought it would be more respectful to the fans to take a break and go and build that new attraction.
JT, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Vegans who grumble about a lack of public outdoor spaces and cultural venues, to the rescue comes the city of Las Vegas. On September 4th, the city debuted the $190 million Las Vegas Civic Center and Carolyn G. Goodman Plaza. Along with City Hall, it completes a centralized hub for all of the city's operations. It also offers an outdoor plaza for events and a 2,400-square-foot contemporary art gallery. State of Nevada producer Mike Pravat recently spoke with Maggie Plaster, the director of Parks and Recreation and Cultural Affairs for the City of Las Vegas, about the details of the new center.
Maggie, welcome to State of Nevada.
Thank you. So glad to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you here. So first off, what need or lack existed before that this civic center fills?
We had employees all over the city in different locations, and the city council and the city manager's office really wanted us to all be in one location. And that's happened for my department, Parks, Rec, and Cultural Affairs. We were in a bunch of different locations. Now we're on property. But really, they wanted to have a community gathering place where we could bring the community together in one place surrounded by government buildings and our government partners.
So how does the city of Las Vegas see this as serving the community? Is there a general objective for it?
I think they're really proud of the fact that we have civic plazas so that we can have different festivals and support artists and, you know, bring lots of different things downtown to get more people downtown and then to support the building surrounding Civic Plaza.
Now, this civic center has a notable cultural component. Before its plans for the plaza and gallery were in place, was the city detecting a need for more space to have cultural offerings and gatherings?
There's not a lot of green space in downtown, as you know. The biggest space right now is privately owned at Symphony Park. So I think that a lot of great cities have municipal gathering places, and this is what we hope for at the City of Las Vegas.
Now, with other open air spaces at various places within the city's jurisdiction, I'm wondering, how you might book this new plaza differently than, say, the Centennial Hills Park Amphitheater or the Sammy Davis Jr. Festival Plaza at Lorenzi Park?
We are looking at doing our larger events at Civic Plaza because we have this great parking structure next door and then one on the other side of the train tracks. We are moving some of our events to the plaza, like our Tamales and Mariachi Festival that's happening December 6th. That was formerly at the historic Fifth Street School. But then we have really great events like the Las Vegas Book Festival that we're considering not moving to the plaza because it's really great at the historic Fifth Street School.
The city has had a few different places to view art, including the nearby Rotunda Gallery in City Hall. I'm wondering how this new art gallery fits into the existing visual art infrastructure within the city.
We wanted to start with a bang for our first exhibit. And we have a great partner with Heather Harmon and the Las Vegas Museum of Art. And they've arranged for an exhibit called Family Album to come to Las Vegas. So we'll be doing our first exhibition with LACMA. And I feel like this is one of the more significant exhibitions we've ever had at the city of Las Vegas. It's a beautiful gallery, and we have lots of plans to bring new types of exhibitions.
You're referring to LACMA. That's the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, who has a partnership with the forthcoming Las Vegas Museum of Art. And going forward, will local artists play a big part in that gallery space?
That is our hope. The city of Las Vegas did an African American Museum master plan several years ago. And our next step in achieving this master plan is bringing in a exhibition that relates to the master plan. So we've been working with Carmen Beals and Clay T. White. So our second exhibition in the space will be called Rhythm and Resilience, The Pulse of Black Las Vegas, and it will showcase lots of local artists.
Okay. There's also a pretty considerable public art element to this project as well. What does that entail?
We have commissioned the largest in scale and budget piece of public art that the city's ever commissioned. That will be right in the center of the plaza. We did an RFP for that. We also asked for lots of community input, and we landed on a piece called Harmonic Ascension, and it's created by Cliff Garden Studios. They're out of Venice, California.
And will there be other areas of the plaza where there will be public art shown?
We're hoping that we can source other areas, but we do have a second one coming online. Mm-hmm. We used a different process for that, where we worked with Michelle Quinn and her consulting business to bring forward five different proposals to our Las Vegas Arts Commission. Two were from local artists and three were not. And the Arts Commission chose Crystal Ramirez, and The Night We Met is the name of her piece, and that should be installed by the end of the month.
Maggie, thank you so much.
I really appreciate the opportunity to be here. Thank you.
There's no shortage of what to see, hear, and do at any time in Nevada. Here to help us sort out a few of the best options is KNPR producer Mike Rivatt, who oversees the Arts and Culture Beat for Nevada Public Radio. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Paul.
Mike, what is an animation mixtape?
I'm glad you asked. It's a highly curated program of animation shorts. That's the short answer, as it were. And it appears to be the invention of Don Hertzfeldt. He's an Academy Award-nominated animator, and he has arranged an 85-minute animation mixtape to play at the Beverly Theater in downtown Las Vegas from September 19th to 25th. There is a premiere for the program on September 18th, in part because this is the big public debut of Ink Films. Now, this has been discussed on the program before, but Ink Films is the distribution component of the Beverly, and it aims to get this program into theaters beyond Las Vegas, to say nothing of other films in the future. And the program itself will feature animated shorts from the art form's rising stars, other Oscar animated shorts, and older pieces that influence Hertzfeldt, who will himself have a new work in the mix, and he'll be at the premiere, and we'll have a link to the screening time at KNPR.org.
Boy, how mixtapes have changed from just recording songs off the radio. All right. Also debuting on September 18th, a special sort of photography exhibition. What is it?
So this is one that focuses mainly on photography from very high places. These are the sort of images that could bring on vertigo or shivers from, you know, people that are sort of sensitive to heights, I think. The exhibit is called Coming Home, and it's the work of photographer Isaac Drift Wright. And he has an incredible story that was actually detailed in the New York Times not too long ago. He's a former paratrooper who used high-altitude photography as a way of coping with PTSD and other mental health conditions. But police say that his scaling of heights was illegal, and they arrested him and tried to levy enough counts on him to put him away for decades. Wright ultimately won out in the end, and now he's got this incredible exhibit of his dizzying work. And Las Vegas will get to see these works, mostly taken from bridges and skyscrapers and other crazy heights, September 18th through October 25th at Freyboy Art Salon on D. Martin Drive. And Wright will be at the reception on the 18th.
It's a shame it's not being shown at the Strat.
Right.
All right. Give me your last recommendation, Mike.
Well, there's more than one here. I want to start by talking about singer-songwriter Jacob Smigel. Longtime participants of the Las Vegas music scene will know that name. He was a fixture there in the 2000s. He has since moved to Austin. He's become an ER doctor, but he continues to make music and occasionally play in Nevada. He just released his latest album. It's called We Laughed a Lot, Didn't We? To which the indie band Deer Tick serves as the backing band. Jacob is gracing Las Vegas with not one, but three performances on his current tour for that album. He'll play the grand opening of the Las Vegas Civic Center and Plaza on September 20th. One day later, he plays at the Dustland Bar in the evening for the official album release show. In between, on the evening of September 20th, he plays a very DIY festival that we've talked about on the show before. It has a title that I can't repeat in full on the radio, so we'll call it Life is Crud. It's a marathon of musicians inside the host venue dive bar. And outside, there's a poetry stage with another marathon of performers, both literary and musical. And Jacob will play his third set of the weekend on that stage. And folks, this festival goes from 4 p.m. till very late, but it's free, though donations to local charity Girls Rock Vegas are encouraged. It's worth noting that Life is Crud, initially a response to the Life is Beautiful festival, has outlasted its inspiration. Again, that's on September 20.
You sold me at Deer Tick, Mike. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Paul.